big museums can feel overwhelming.
If you come away from your first trip to the British Museum and you've seen 6 objects, 3 famous, 3 not famous, I think you've come away ahead.
Historian Mary Beard helps us approach the world's largest collection of antiquities in the heart of London. Bob Eckstein likes to sketch what he observes at museums all across the USA. He shares memories from the grandest to the quirkiest of collections.
The museums can be anything. Museums don't have to be what we traditionally think of as paintings on the wall, but it can be all sorts of things.
And to view something spectacular, look for the free-form divers of Jeju Island when you visit South Korea.
It's also incredible to see women in their 70s, even 80s. Some of them can't really walk, and then all of a sudden they dive and they can move like mermaids.
It's all in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Writer Chaney Kwok has tips for enjoying the heart of South Korea in both its hypermodern capital and among the tranquil traditions on Jeju Island. And Bob Eckstein shares what it is to love museums by illustrating memorable moments at his favorites across North America. They join us in a bit on today's Travel with Rick Steves. In the 19th century, the British Empire collected art and ancient artifacts about as fast as they collected colonies. Today at the British Museum, you can follow the rise and fall of the Egyptian, Greek, and Assyrian civilizations. But while the sun never set on the British Empire, you're likely to lose daylight as you try to see it all in just a few hours. So we've asked one of Britain's best-loved classic scholars, Dame Mary Beard, to help us absorb what the British Museum has to offer. Her first visit to the British Museum as a 5-year-old helped shape her curiosity. And today, she's a trustee of that same massive museum. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So you're a trustee of the British Museum. Wow, what does that mean? And you're a busy person. That would take a lot of time. Why do you care?
It takes a lot of time, and I care for all kinds of reasons, but one is a very personal reason, because it was, in some ways, if I try to go back to the very beginning of my interest in the ancient world, it came about from a visit to the British Museum when I was 5.
Oh.
It was the first time that I'd been to London. And I was with my mum, and she said, we must go and see the British Museum. And I wanted to see the Egyptian mummies, of course, because that's what kids always want to see. She said, we're going to go and also look at what the Egyptians did during their life, not their death. So we went to the Everyday Life Galleries of Egypt. Mm. And this was in 1960, and museums back in 1960 were not child-friendly. So we were looking around, but I couldn't really see into the cases. And my mum suddenly said, oh, my goodness me, there's a piece of ancient Egyptian cake. And I said, oh, I've got to see that. I've got to see that. But it was very hard for me to see. And she tried to lift me up, but I still couldn't really see. And I was getting pretty frustrated when a guy walks by, and you must have been a curator, because he put his hands in his pocket. He got some keys out. He opened the case. He extracted the piece of cake. And he showed it to me right in front of my nose. I was 2 inches from this piece of Egyptian cake.
Egyptian cake. And this kindled a lifetime, a passion of interest in teaching ancient history.
Yeah, well, it did. You know, and I never became an Egyptologist and I never learned hieroglyphs. So it wasn't a direct influence.
Right.
But it was still something that was utterly, utterly unforgettable. And it was that museum experience. And not just the museum. It was the curator in the museum seeing a kid who wanted to see something and opening the case and getting it out.
What a great metaphor and a good example of how there was a need for museums to evolve a bit, and they have.
Yeah, they have. You know, now kids can see the cake much more easily than I ever could.
So as a trustee of the British Museum, just very briefly, what's your goal? What's your purpose?
I want to make the museum better. I want to look at some of the bits of its past that I think we rightly now feel anxious about. And I want to work out how we can really share this collection with the world. I mean, I think when you think about the great objects of world cultural heritage, I don't think it's necessarily very helpful to say who owns those. We all own them. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that's been most satisfying for me is seeing, and it, you know, it's a slow process, but seeing the way that these collections have begun to be shared across the globe much more ambitiously. At this very minute, there is an exhibition in Mumbai, and it's going to be on show for several years. It includes classical monuments from the British Museum, from the Getty, from Berlin, put next to Indian ancient artifacts. And it is wonderful.
Whoa, that is such a beautiful global appreciation of culture. Mumbai is former Bombay, right?
Yes.
So a billion Indians can have a chance to go to their big city and check it out.
Yeah. And also, and I think what's exciting about it, is that we learn things, we in the British Museum say, we learn things about the objects from the British Museum, seeing them in a different context, seeing people respond to them differently, seeing them next to the Indian objects.
Yep.
And suddenly, stuff that I thought I was familiar with when I went to Mumbai, I saw it in a different light.
Dame Mary Beard is an author of some 20 books on classical civilizations, including Emperor of Rome, Ruling the Ancient Roman World. She teaches the classics at Cambridge and is known for her many history series on BBC TV. In 2020, Mary was named a trustee of the British Museum. So this is a great thing to be looking at as we go to the great museums of the world in our travels now. And when you go to London, the British Museum is arguably the single most important museum you should check out. But there is this growing appreciation of the ethics of keeping the art of foreign lands and the responsibility, and is it owned by anybody? And of course, sort of the cover girl of this whole issue is the Elgin marbles, which are now called the Parthenon marbles. Which I would say Elgin is emblematic of British imperialism. He was a fancy lord who decided, I want to take these from Greece to London. But of course, it's a complicated issue. And I would just like your take on that, because whether you like it or not, you know, people wonder when they go to the British Museum, well, isn't this just British imperialism?
I mean, I think that Elgin is a complicated man. We have no idea what his real motives are. I mean, I would not want to say he was a selfless humanitarian wanting to save the marbles, nor would I want to say that he just wanted to decorate his country house. I think we don't know. I think that what I've come to see, and this is partly by being a trustee, is that, yes, these issues are important, and they're probably very hard to solve. But there has never been a time in the history of modern museums when people haven't worried about what is where, who can see it, who it belongs to, where it should be. And museum objects have always been contested, and people have always wanted to put them in a different place. And to some extent, I think that that shows how important the idea of these objects is.
Well, that is an example of, or illustrates the appreciation of these treasures, which is great.
If we didn't argue about them, you know, we might as well forget about them.
I think there's two kind of issues. Where is it safer from a practical point of view, and where will it be seen by more people? I mean, that's probably not a justification if you're losing that art. But I think it does make sense that if nobody can go to St. Petersburg, take the treasures of the Hermitage and show them in Amsterdam.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but what I do think, and I think it's along the same lines, is that I think one of the ways that we can make global heritage real is move the objects around a bit more.
Yes.
You know? I think that we should have a much more active project of sharing objects.
Huh.
In the case of the Elgin marbles, you know, I'm not going to say that the position we're now in is ideal, and I don't think anybody thinks it's ideal. Mm-hmm. It's been argued about for 200 years. Now, usually when things are argued about for 200 years, it's because there is a problem there, but it's one that's very hard to solve.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm with, I think, almost everybody in the world who would like to see a reasonable and responsible solution to this. But I want it to go hand in hand with a much greater willingness to share objects. You know, it's kind of all very well to say, as we used to say, look, anybody can come to the British Museum to see these things. Well, you know, we're now much more realistic about saying that's not the case.
Right.
Well, in which case, how do we share these objects? Now, to some extent, the digital world makes some of that a bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think that we can say, if you want this to be the world's museum, and I think that, you know, one of the ideas that we've debating in the British Museum is, you know, to what extent can you see the British Museum not as a kind of repository, not as an Aladdin's cave of wonderful stuff, but can you see it as a lending library? You know, this is a lending library for the world. And that is where I'd like to go.
And I know that Michelangelo's Pietà made a trip to the United States back 50 or 60 years ago, and it still reverberates. People saw Michelangelo's Pietà who would never see their name on a plane ticket to Italy.
No, that's right. And, you know, I discovered only this week that in the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., embedded in that monument is a block of the Parthenon.
Ah, I love that. Mary, we've just got a couple minutes left in our time together, but let's say I'm your guest in London and I've never been to the British Museum and you're my guide. What would our approach be?
Not to see too much. I mean, I think that there's a terrible tendency, and it's an understandable tendency, to think, right, I've got a morning and I'm going to see the whole lot. I'm going to see as much as I can. And I'm going to go from the Rosetta Stone to the Parthenon marbles. And I think my motto about museums always now, perhaps it is because I'm getting older and I need to sit down more, but less is more. You know, pick three things that you'd really like to see, whatever those are, and it doesn't matter. And on the way to those three things, stop by another three things that you didn't know about and have a look at those. So if you come away from your first trip to the British Museum and you've seen six objects, three famous, three not famous, I think you'd come away ahead. You know, I know when you get back, your friends will say, but didn't you see the, you know, whatever? And you have to say, no, I spent a lot of time getting to know six objects really, really well. That's my advice.
I love it. And, you know, I agree with you, especially in the case of London. For the rest of our lives, if we like to travel, we'll be going back through London. Isn't it a blessing to not have, quote, seen the British Museum?
That's right.
So you can go back and back and back.
And it's, it's free.
It's free. It's free. And that's because of the great work of the trustees at the British Museum. Mary Beard, thank you so much for joining us. And I want to see you in London one day and I'll take you up on a tour, okay?
Absolutely.
Thanks so
thank
much.
You. Bye. Thank you.
By the way, I narrate a one-hour audio tour of the British Museum that you can listen to with earbuds as you explore its collections. It's at ricksteves.com/radio. Bob Eckstein first visited a museum as a kid on a family road trip, complete with little brother asking over and over, "Are we there yet?" As an adult, Bob has experienced dozens of museums of all types across North America. He writes and sketches about them in Footnotes from the Most Fascinating Museums. Bob joins us next. And later in the hour, travel writer Chaney Kwok recommends what to explore in a week in South Korea. It's Travel with Rick Steves. If going on a road trip to see museums doesn't always sound like your cup of tea, you should try seeing them the way that Bob Eckstein does. In just over a year, Bob visited 75 museums from a wish list he compiled all across the United States, plus a few in Mexico and Canada. They included major must-see institutions in big cities, as well as newer specialty-themed museums and small, quirky, one-of-a-kind collections. As a humorist and cartoonist for The New Yorker magazine, Bob sketched up his own impressions from these museums and added in stories from friends and people he met about what they loved about their museums and put it all together in an illustrated book called Footnotes from the Most Fascinating Museums. Bob joins us now from his home near Scranton, Pennsylvania, to tell us all about it. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rick. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you know, I just love talking to somebody who loves museums. That's kind of like my middle name, too. And you're, like you say, obsessed with museums. How does that happen?
You know, I remember my first museum was the American Museum of Natural History and how it brought you to these worlds that you couldn't normally go to. As a matter of fact, like your show brings me to places, the museums can do the same. Like, it shows me a slice of things that I just normally wouldn't see. And as an artist, I get inspired by what I see as well.
You mentioned there are something like 35,000 museums in the United States. Talk about daunting. And you had to choose 75 to feature in your book.
Oh, yeah. And the list was actually much greater. Initially, the list might have been like 200. And yeah. I was collecting at the same time stories that went with it. So I had many stories for each museum. And then we try to narrow down to the top 75 to say which ones were the most important historically, which ones were most important to the art community, which ones had good community input, like help the community with programs, education, things like that, which ones were the sexiest. And there's all different factors that decided which would be the most interesting top 75. In some cases, the stories were just so great that I knew I wanted to share the stories with my readers, and I knew I had to find a place in the book.
Because that is interesting. I don't have stories in my museum listings. They're just more encyclopedic. And you've got these stories that really give it a life, rather than just saying how many rooms there are and when it's open and what is the collection. And you also complemented the coverage with your own sketches. Tell us your thinking behind that. Why did you illustrate with your own sketches rather than simply photographs? And why did you devote all of the time and energy into interviews and stories rather than the data?
Well, it's not me who's the star of the book. It's the people I interviewed. My illustrations, the job of that is just to be background music. I try to do the best I could to make each of the museums appealing, attractive. I want people to feel like they need to go to that museum and experience that story themselves in some way. But it's really the story that is front and center.
Because many people go to a museum because you got to go to that museum when you're in this town. And many people go to the museum because they've got to see the Mona Lisa. But what you're trying to do, it seems, is to remind people, as a human being, as a thoughtful, curious person, this museum can have an impact on you in a way that you can't even imagine until you go in there and let serendipity do its thing.
Oh, there's one story that took place at the Art Institute of Chicago with a man who was contemplating suicide. And on his way to kill himself, he stopped off at the museum and he found himself engaged with a piece of artwork on the wall that changed his life. This person happened to be comedian Bill Murray. And it's an example how art can change our life. It's amazing the power of art. And as someone who's been to so many museums in that short time of 2 years, I feel that inspiration and the change in me.
Yeah.
I would go home so motivated and inspired to paint. I couldn't wait to get back to document how I spent the day.
So you're saying Bill Murray was considering suicide?
That's true. At a low point in his life.
Wow.
Yeah. And I have stories from people who are regular people. I mean, Bill Murray's a regular person, but I have all walks of life showing how people who went to museums in some form or another had a life-changing experience.
And there's a lot of thought that goes into these museums. A lot of people don't realize it, but, their curators work long and hard to make the presentation enjoyable and informative.
Yeah, and actually another thing people take for granted is that if you went to the museum, they feel like, well, that's the end of it. But museums are very organic. They evolve and they change to meet the needs of people. And they're always changing, just like society's changing, because it mirrors what we're doing. It's sort of a closet of all the things we've accomplished, including our mistakes. And when you go back to these museums, you'll see drastic changes a lot of times with different exhibits and stuff like that. So I certainly encourage people to reconsider going back to their favorites.
Bob Eckstein is the author and illustrator of Footnotes from the Most Fascinating Museums. Bob's also written Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores and The Illustrated History of the Snowman. He shares cartoons and writing tips on Substack at The Bob, and his website is bobeckstein.com. So, Bob, I'm, as I mentioned, obviously with all my guidebooks that I'm researching, assessing guidebooks, because it's my responsibility to find out, is it worth the time and the money of my travelers to spend a part of their vacation in this or that place? And I find that a lot of museums have no historical artifacts. And if a place has no historical artifacts, it's very tough for me to like it. I really want actual old stuff. And a lot of places are gimmicky museums that are just like a money-making kit. I mean, torture dungeons, Dali exhibits, Leonardo models brought to life. And you find them scattered all over Europe, and they're really more entertainment than museums. What are your pet peeves? What do you not like about certain museums that you think are basically without a mission other than trying to make some money?
That's a tough question because I enjoy museums so much. For the most part, I was enjoying my trips to the museums, and I like to kind of challenge you to be more open to some museums that don't just have old stuff. Like, are you a car guy? If you love cars, there's a couple of museums in LA that are fantastic if you don't
art. They have real cars. I mean,
they have real cars.
I'm not a car guy, but I've been to two or three car museums in the last year that just blew me away.
Yeah, I loved them.
I was just down in Florida, in Naples, and I went to a car museum, and it was just an eccentric, wealthy guy's collection of cars
that he opened up to the public.
Yep. It was great, and it was great because it was real, it was one person's passion, and it was beautifully described.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I was really surprised by how, when I went to all these different new museums, even like something like the Museum of Bad Art,
yeah,
that it had me thinking a different way. And that, I think that's the most important thing about a museum is that you leave there thinking differently.
It makes you rethink things. I've been to museums that change you. They're a transformative experience, and that is great. So the Museum of Bad Art, tell me what it is.
It's actually a collection of the most hideous, offensive artwork that is so bad, it's good.
I've seen museums that have that kind of theme, and they go, yes, this is the Museum of Bad Art, but it's nothing but the best bad art.
The best of the bad. I love collecting bad art. I have a lot of artwork in my house, and bad art,
I like naive art, and that's art by idiot savants, you know, from the...
Oh, that's like my favorite artwork is outsider art, and I have to recommend really quickly, the Baltimore's Visionary Art Museum is fabulous for outsider art. If you're in Baltimore, you must check out their outsider art
museum. Okay, that's interesting. It's called outsider art. When you're in Switzerland, there's the Brut Art Collection on Lake Geneva. And it's done by people who were locked up because they were considered criminally insane. And you just feel like their vision of the world was just totally apart from mine. And it was just so fascinating. And that's an example of a museum that can humble you and take you out of what you think is the norm. I was struck by the fact that you particularly loved the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles. What was it of all the museums that you see that you thought you'd isolate that one as an example of one that particularly worked for you?
Well, there's times in which I consider it my favorite museum. The museum is sort of the Andy Kaufman of museums. It is very unpredictable. I don't want to give away the joke here, but to experience that museum is something that you'll never forget. And I don't want to ruin that experience by telling so much, except to say they turn the concept of what a museum can be and what the experience can be and turns it on its head.
Huh. So that classic, you know, in Europe, there are certain museums that pride themselves in being Victorian. I mean, they're 19th century. They're from the 1800s. They haven't changed. But of course, there's a much bigger movement to make museums interactive and to connect with the visitor.
Yeah.
Experiential, right? What's an example of some creative things that are being done that you think are great?
Well, I mean, I'm doing just that. I'm trying to raise awareness to humanize the museums because our first perception of museums is someplace that can feel like homework. But I try to explain there's a museum for everyone. And an example of sort of an out-of-the-box, sort of state-of-the-art new technology used in museums is that if you go to the National Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York, the first thing you do is you kind of get tested very briefly on your sense of humor. And once they analyze what your sense of humor is, you're given this information band that you wear on your wrist. And when you walk through the museum, the exhibit changes to accommodate your sensibilities and humor.
Yes, I had the same experience in Berlin at the Humboldt Forum. It's the biggest site in Berlin that's new. And the museum there, you wear a wristband, and every time you leave a room, you answer a question, and you walk through the door on the left or the door on the right, and that's your vote. And when you're all done with the museum, you get a printout that analyzes how you responded emotionally and psychologically to the experience you just had. And a lot of times I feel like these are trying too hard, but that one really worked well for me. And I thought, man, that took this museum going to another level. I learned without even realizing it when I got through that experience. It was wonderful.
Yeah, Rick, you know, it also makes what kind of is a perception of museums of being cold and gives them a warmth. It really makes it more personal. And I mean, my book was trying to make all the stories feel personal and show a side of the museums you wouldn't normally think of.
Our guest on Travel with Rick Steves is Bob Eckstein. As a humorist and cartoonist, Bob focuses on the little things that offer moments of joy when visiting all types of museums across North America. His illustrated book is called Footnotes from the Most Fascinating Museums. Bob also co-hosts an occasional podcast with a fellow New Yorker cartoonist. It's called The Cartoon Pad. You know, I always think that people are always looking to me for budget tricks. You know, how can I get into the museum for half price? Is it worth going on Thursday mornings when it's free or whatever? And I think that's not that productive. I think what's most productive is when you think about value, is to realize the more you bring to a museum in context and understanding, the more you'll get out of the visit.
True, true. And you're bringing up a point that I really didn't focus totally on the book, which is attitude. Bringing the right attitude with you, that you're open and that you're not going to be just seeing what is considered the landmark pieces, like you said, the Mona Lisa and stuff, but discovering for yourself. An example is that the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is arguably the most important museum in the world next to the Louvre, they have a section called the Visionary Archives, which no one goes to, and it's a section that's really not meant for display, but the public has access to it. And there you have all the artwork that's not formally on display, but you could go check it out.
Huh. See, this is a dimension of a museum that only the kind of A-plus student would even consider. I always think about that when I go back to my favorite museums. I do the same well-worn route every time as everybody else does, and they complain about the crowds in that museum when there are wings of that museum that are just as worthwhile that nobody goes to. Let's talk a little bit about the museums. You mentioned the Met in New York City, apparently the largest collection in the Western Hemisphere. Of course, the Smithsonian is huge. What's that, a collection of like 20 or 21 different museums? What are the top five or six institutions? I mean, just great museums that they're no secret, but you got to see them, you know, when you're in Chicago, when you're in Los Angeles, when you're in D.C. or New York.
Well, I distinguish that in my book by giving them a full spread. There are some museums that are just so large you can't even see in one day, and they're so important. They cover almost every culture, as you mentioned. You could go to the Met and go into the lower level, and that's enough for one day.
And in those kind of cases, it's a blessing you can't see it all and don't try to. If you try to blitz the whole thing, you're just going to exhaust yourself and be overwhelmed. You've got the rest of your life to go back to New York City. Why not see the Met as several different collections and you focus smartly on one at a time? Of course, the same thing with the great museums in Washington, D.C. What about the Art Institute of Chicago?
Well, that's a favorite. I love that museum, and it has some very iconic paintings. You asked me what are the top five. I'll mention the Peabody Essence Museum, Massachusetts. Amazing museum. There's Mass MoCA. I could spend my whole life there. I could live somewhere in there, and I would be happy.
Mass MoCA. What is Mass MoCA?
Mass MoCA is contemporary artwork and has on display some of my favorite contemporary artists. And when I go there, I'm also torn about having to go to another museum, because I don't want to forget what I just saw.
And what city is that in?
It's all the way up in the northern western corner up by Adams.
You said there's like, what, 600 museums in Massachusetts or something like that?
There's so many museums. I mean, the Clark Museum, the Sleeper House, which is one of the most amazing homes, which inspired my home. I had refixed my home, a fixer-upper, to include secret passages after having an unforgettable day at the Sleeper Museum near Cape Cod in Massachusetts.
So what is Sleeper Museum? What does that mean?
The Sleeper House is a house that this man constructed a century ago that everything has been custom made, and it's just a dream house. And that's an example of how the museums can be anything. Museums don't have to be what we traditionally think of as paintings on the wall, but it could be all sorts of things.
Also, Bob, you wrote going on vacation as a kid was a masterclass in boredom. That is a great line. And it's true. Kids get dragged to these museums. Part of your mission, I think, in your book is to help families to develop a smart bucket list for their summer vacation when they take the kids out and introduce kids to museums in a positive way. Which museums do you applaud for being kid-friendly?
Oh, you'd be surprised. Almost all of them try. And the most important part that they do is they make it affordable. And there's even some museums that are free. But a lot of museums also have free nights and times in the day that you could bring your family for free. And this is something that was on my mind while writing the book about how expensive it is today to, let's say, bring a family of four people to Yankee Stadium to watch a ball game. Never mind Yankee Stadium. Try to bring them to a minor league game. Tickets could be $65 for each person, and then the food and everything. So I'm trying to bring up the fact that museums have actually made themselves approachable.
And I would just think from a parenting point of view, or from a point of view of anybody that wants to have a transformational travel experience, to make your museum going a little more thoughtful is really worthwhile. Bob Eckstein, thanks so much for your passion for museums and sharing it. It's kind of infectious. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rick.
See you in a museum someday, either in New York or maybe New Delhi.
Careful, I'm holding you to that.
We've got more with Bob Eckstein in an extra from this week's interview as he tells us about an archive of curious scents in Berkeley, California, and the amazing Mark Twain home in Hartford, Connecticut. You can hear it where we post this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Our museum theme continues next week on Travel with Rick Steves with Elaine Chelino from Paris. She'll take a closer look at the women of the Louvre Museum in what is otherwise a man's world of classic art. Up next, travel writer Chaney Kwok shares what he likes best about visiting his family origins in South Korea, with a mix of big city excitement and unwinding in a traditional Korean village by the sea.
Γεια σας, είμαι ο Απόστολος, από την Αθήνα, από την Ελλάδα, και ταξιδεύω με τον Rick Steves. And what I just said in Greek was, I'm Apostolos from Athens, Greece, and I travel with Rick Steves. And now we'll say it again in Greek. Είμαι ο Απόστολος, από την Αθήνα, από την Ελλάδα, και ταξιδεύω με τον Rick Steves.
If Korean-American travel writer Chaney Kwok had 1 week to spend in South Korea, he'd start with 3 days in the capital of Seoul, where the bright lights and modern skyline and hip shopping and nonstop delicious foods are legendary. But he'd spend most of his time 2 hours away in a more traditional area few foreigners know about. The mystical island of Jeju is the complete opposite of Seoul. Even the Korean dialect they speak there is closer to the languages of centuries past. Jeju is where shamans bless the villagers every spring and where women, free-form divers, go deep every day to bring up the freshest of seafood. Chaney joins us now to see Seoul in 3 busy days and then share what it's like to meet the women of Jeju, eat their fresh seafood, and enjoy the Seoul of Korea. Chaney, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Chaney, first of all, you're, first-generation American. How did your family end up in the United States?
You know, a funny story is that my uncle, who landed in Washington, D.C. in the 60s, thought Washington, D.C. must be the capital, the greatest city. Something traumatic happened. He wouldn't talk about it, but he wanted to get away as far from Washington, D.C. as possible. He looked at the map, said Seattle, and he took the bus across, and then he started bringing his family over. So all the Kwoks in Washington State were used to be related to each other up until the late 90s.
Now, is your family, does it have a relationship with the old country? Did you go back there as a child? And how well connected are you with the relatives back in Korea?
Absolutely. Every few years, I try to make it back to Korea. It's been a couple of years now because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But my mother's side of the family is all in Korea as well, outside of Seoul, which is one of the reasons why I'm really familiar with Seoul and also have this great personal connection. My mom was born in Seoul, which is something she's proud of. And yeah.
Give us an introduction to Seoul, first of all. How would you describe Seoul to somebody who's maybe been to Tokyo?
Yeah, it's a controversial take, but I want to say that actually you should start your first Asian trip in Seoul. Because for one, it's a great gateway with lots of connections to all around the world, but it's also not a tourist trap. It's a thriving, even throbbing metropolis of almost 10 million people. And you really get a slice of real life, what it's like to live in a very hyper-modern Asian country. Mm-hmm. I also want to say it's a terrific place to be jet-lagged because it's a 24-hour kind of city. So if you want to get a perm or eat a meal or what have you, go for clothing shopping at 3 a.m., it's not a problem.
Oh, yeah. I saw you did the 36 hours in Seoul thing for the New York Times, and it was the photograph there. It just looks like bright daylight in the middle of the night with all of the neons going on. I'm just going to list a couple of points, and I'd like to get your take on it because we have these clichetic images of Seoul. First of all, the pop industry. I mean, you know, Korean pop is actually it's an economic initiative by the government to be the trendsetters in popular culture. What's the scene in Seoul?
You know, it's not quite like the music videos per se, but the fashion does change really fast, as do all the slang words. And you really hear that soundtrack of K-pop wherever you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about, and you know, we all know Gangnam, and it's a place.
Seoul's divided into two generally by the river that flows and bisects it. So Gangnam just means south of the river. Mm. That's the place with more money because it was developed in the 80s leading up to the 1988 Seoul Olympics. Used to be a more agricultural, but now it's a lot of skyscrapers and new money. And Gangnam Style is kind of a parody of that kind of gaudiness of new money.
Oh, so it's a parody on Nouveau Riche.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that explains something for me. And it sounds almost related to my next question. I understand there's a kind of tourism there called beauty tourism.
I wish I could partake in that. Korea is known for its plastic surgery skills and industry, shall we say. So there are a lot of tourists from all around Asia who come aspiring for that kind of K-pop, K-drama standard of beauty.
Cheney, I was in Singapore and I was in Shanghai and I was blown away by the futuristic shopping. And I have a sense that Seoul can compete with these cities. Like, you've got the biggest subterranean mall in all of Asia, 1,000 shops. Talk about the futuristic shopping.
Well, the subterranean mall happens to be in Gangnam, our favorite place.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true, there are a lot of shopping malls, glitzy and whatnot. But I tell tourists going to Korea to experience Dongdaemun, which is used to be a wholesaler market, and this is the place where you can go 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning to check out the latest fashion that's about to take over the K-pop aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
As well as Namdaemun, which is the South Gate, literally in Korean, where you can sample a lot of street food and get a pair of glasses done in an hour.
Hmm.
I think there are a lot of remnants of old Korea in Seoul as well. So even though there are a lot of shopping malls, you can still find alleyways where people are selling dried vegetables. And one of the more off-the-beaten-path places I would recommend would be Gyeongdong Market. There's mm-hmm. an alley that sells medicinal herbs only. It's quite an experience to walk down and just smell the pungent ginseng and different kinds of medicinal herbs.
Travel writer Cheney Kwok divides his time between San Francisco and Seoul. He's recommending his favorite highlights for visiting South Korea right now in this visit from the Travel with Rick Steves archives. You can read his article about the sea women of Jeju Island at cheneykwok.com. That's spelled K-W-A-K. You can also listen to our conversation about the cruise ship nightmare Cheney survived off the stormy coast of Arctic Norway. It's linked from this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. His book about the ordeal is called The Passenger. Hey, I was going to ask you just from a practical point of view, what about the language barrier for somebody like me who doesn't speak a word of Korean? And what are the costs compared to the United States? And are there day tours that can give you a good bearing for Seoul?
Yeah, so Incheon International Airport actually arranges day tours if you just happen to be transiting for a day. For free, I believe, actually. I'm going to have to fact check that.
Uh-huh.
But so if you happen to be passing through, you can actually get in a bus arranged by the Korean government to take a look at
nice.
Seoul. As far as the language is concerned, it is true. Unlike Singapore, English is not the official language. Korean is. The good news is that Seoul, young people will speak English, and also street signs are going to be in English as well. But I like to tell people to learn how to read Korean when they go to Seoul because it is a completely phonetic script. And I have a friend who learned to read and write during his flight over to Korea. It's an extremely logical and easy script to learn, and you'll be surprised how much you can actually read because even though Korean is a very different language, a lot of words come from English now. So you'll be walking down the street and you'll see a road sign and realize, oh, it says massage.
Give us a quick tip on eating. I mean, I'm sure we're going to check out pork belly barbecue and kimchi. What should be on our list for enjoying the cuisine of Korea?
I would say you should go out to the sidewalk tent eateries, a lot of street food in the afternoon as well as throughout the night, and you're going to find all sorts of different things. Tteokbokki, which is really spicy rice cake, is a staple, as well as gilgari toast, which means street toast. It's a sandwich of all sorts of yummy things made right in front of you on a griddle, right on the street.
Mm. That sounds like fun. Just street food in pop-up tents.
Bottles and bottles of soju shared with your friends. That's just the norm. And there's a culture of counting the rounds that you do, not as in one place, mind you. When you say ilta, that means the first round in one place. You go to ita, samcha. You keep adding different pit stops, inevitably ending up in a karaoke bar.
If I went to Korea as somebody who's obviously not Korean, and I had a spirit of adventure and I took my nap in the afternoon, I could go out at night and make some friends and go to a series of little pop-up tent bars and share buying rounds for everybody and have a fun evening?
For sure. I would start in Itaewon, which has a lot of foreigners, and then you can venture out from there. I love Itaewon, actually, because it's the truly multicultural part of Seoul where you would see a mosque next to a gay bar. It's the only place in Korea, in fact, that you would see that. A lot of the establishments cater to American English teachers and soldiers who are stationed there. So you can get your bearings there and then start expanding.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Chaney Kwok, and Chaney is the author of a book called The Passenger, which talks about an adventure he had on a cruise ship that nearly sank up in Norway. And right now we're joining Chaney and talking about his family's homeland, Korea. And Chaney, if I had 3 days in Seoul, before we get out into the countryside, because I want to go there in a moment, give me just a quick look. We've talked about a lot of general things, but how would you be glad that you had 3 days in the big city of Korea, Seoul?
Yeah, first night, jet-lagged, go to Dongdaemun, go to wholesalers' fashion market, and then eat a lot of street food. Second night, Itaewon, lots of expats as well as diverse kinds of people. And I would also make sure to spend some time during the day in Gangbuk, north of the river, where all old houses are still in existence next to skyscrapers. There's a place called Bukchon, which has traditional Korean homes just cascading down a hill. And from there, you can see the rising skyscrapers. It's quite an experience. Hmm. And if I can recommend a couple of off-the-beaten-path places, a Korean Furniture Museum, which is a private museum inside a traditional house, has exquisite collections of traditional furniture, and they do tours in English. In fact, you have to make an appointment to go there. And then there's also a place called a Korean Stone Art Museum, all about art sculptures made out of stone. But it's interesting because the name in Korean is not exactly Korean Stone Art Museum. It is Uri Yetdol Bakmulgan, which means our old stone museum, literally. And I think there's something kind of poetic about that, that kind of old stone and celebrating that. In a city, hyper-modern city like Seoul, I think you need a stop like that.
Let's say we've done Seoul, and just this conversation makes me want to go to Seoul for the first time in my life, I got to be honest. I want to check this out. But you balance it with a trip to the countryside, and you've got this one favorite place. It's just a couple hours away, an island the size of Maui with about only 700,000 people in it, and it's called Jeju. Why would you go to Jeju? What's there?
You know, the one word that Koreans would associate with Jeju would be pure. Its water is renowned, and it's just a very different place than Seoul, even though it's only about 300 miles south. By no means is it a secret, because a lot of Koreans will have gone there, if not would aspire to go there, because it is beautiful. Canola mm-hmm. flowers fluttering in the air, and there's this dramatic volcano that's been dormant for thousands of years. But more than the natural beauty, I think it's a really intriguing place. The island of Jeju likes to pride itself as the island of 180,000 gods. There's a lot of shamanism, or remnants of shamanism, whether it's in the form of shrines or in the form of gud, which is a ceremony that a shaman would perform in order to ward off evil and make offerings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough to see one of those, and it's quite an interesting experience to see someone go into a trance and walk on sharp blades, sharp enough to cut silk, but then they would dance on this two propped up blades.
You mentioned there's a kind of a culture of artists that are escaping the urban intensity and setting up galleries in Jeju.
That's the modern spin of it. So these days, a lot of people burnt out in Seoul would flee down there and either open a pension or coffee shop, or just dedicate their lives to painting. And there are a lot of galleries that have opened up, as well as actually quite a prestigious gallery called Arario, which took up actually a couple of old rundown motels and turned them into this really incredible contemporary art experiences.
Nice. Now, I was going to ask you about the seafood in this island, Jeju, J-E-J-U. But I think before you talk about the seafood, you got to talk about this unique tradition of women deep divers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they're called haenyeo, which literally means sea women. These are women free divers who would go down there to collect mollusks and seaweed like kelp, you know, sea cucumbers, abalone, all sorts of things. You know, in 1965, there were over 23,000 haenyeo, which would make them about one in five women in the province at the time. Today, the total population has doubled, and there are fewer than 4,000 active haenyeo. 90% of them are actually over the age of 60. So it is kind of a dying art.
Are they diving without a scuba tank? They're just holding their breath?
They're just holding their breath. And in fact, into the 70s, they were wearing nothing but cotton. So they didn't even have neosprene to shield them. I asked one of them, isn't that kind of, you know, silly? Why don't you wear an oxygen tank, you know? And she said, are you crazy? What would my grandchildren eat? I could clean out the whole island in a day.
Ah, so that's it. They thought it's just more sporty if they don't have the advantage of a scuba tank.
It's also an interest in sustainability.
Yes,
you know,
that's a beautiful sensibility. That is a beautiful sensibility. And this survives to this day. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's also incredible to see women in their 70s, even 80s. Some of them can't really walk. And then all of a sudden, they dive and they can move like mermaids because they're so much more used to working undersea. It is a really rough profession. And, you know, unfortunately, many of them develop diseases later on. But when it comes to diving, they seem to do it just fine well into their 80s.
Huh. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Cheney Kwok. Fascinating discussion about Korea. You know, Cheney, if you're on this amazing island of Jeju, describe a memorable meal you had there. I hope it features a little seafood after these women are diving so deep to get it.
Absolutely. And this reinforces my argument that you should learn to read Korean, because I saw a sign that said haenyeo sikdang, which literally just means a restaurant run by a sea woman. Went in there and an ex-diver was making meals made out of all the goodies that her colleagues had collected that day. Really spicy stew of all sorts of seafood and abalone just shucked and fresh enough that even though, I feel bad, it's dead, it's sort of kind of moving.
sort of. If it's moving, it's moving. It's not sort of kind of moving.
It is pulsating. I'm sorry to say.
Pulsating. That makes it even more appetizing.
Well, you got to do what you got to do. When in Rome. When on Jeju.
Okay, so you had fresh seafood. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, there
Sounds
you go.
Amazing. Hey, Cheney Kwok, this has been a fun exploration. Thanks for sharing. And Let's just, final thought, if I go to Korea for the first time in my life, what's a tangible souvenir I might want to bring home, and what's an intangible souvenir that you think would be good for me to take home as well?
Well, the tangible souvenir, I would say face masks, all sorts of skin creams, cosmetic products. And the intangible souvenir I could recommend would be going to Jeju and just being really quiet and listening for some dolphin-like sounds. It's called sumbi, and it's the sound that the sea women make as they emerge into the water and they exhale the last bit of breath. It's the most incredible sound you'll hear.
That is a beautiful moment. Cheney Kwok, thank you so much for sharing your family's homeland, and best wishes with your travel writing.
Thank you, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Since 1973, I've spent about 100 days a year exploring Europe. My mission? To empower Americans to have European trips that are fun, affordable, and culturally broadening. With my 100 well-traveled colleagues, we produce America's best-selling guidebook series and organize small group tours to take over 30,000 travelers every year to Europe. If you're dreaming of a European adventure, whether on your own or with a tour, we'd love to help you make it happen.